Hello everyone, Corwin here with a quick word before the episode starts. This interview is with Maggie Gravett and it's one of my favourite shows on the channel so far. We did record this in early March 2020 before the COVID-19 crisis had properly hit in the UK and the lockdown was announced, so there will be some references to events that have since been cancelled or postponed. Putting that aside, it's a great episode and I hope you enjoy it too. Hello, welcome back to Railway Mania. I'm here today with Maggie Gravett. Maggie's going to talk about getting children involved in railway modelling and how to nurture their interest and get them involved in real modelling and not just box opening. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with a really simple outline question, which is, how were you introduced to modelling and how did you become interested in it?
I married Gordon. That's how I got involved in modelling. I had never, ever had involvement with railway modelling at all. And 1973, I met my husband and married him. And he didn't tell me he did railway modelling. In fact, he showed no interest at all. It was all to do with motor racing, which in 1973 was extremely cool and glamorous. And of course, 2 years later, when the son was born, well, you have to have a train set, don't you, when you have a little boy. And he then got involved and he built a small narrow gauge Welsh layout to take out to exhibitions. And our son went with him. Mainly because our son was quite interested. He was about 7 or 8 by then. And then rugby came along and beer and girls a bit, I suppose, by the time he was 13, 14. And he didn't want to go with dad anymore. So I went and I would just move a train up and down. Gordon would go and have his lunch. I'd move a train up and down, smile at people. And that was it. But then you get asked, what did you do on this layout? Well, I quite fancied doing something. So we then decided we would build our first O-gauge layout, which was called Ditchling Green. And he showed me how to do brickwork. So a lot of the brickwork on the walls of Ditchling Green, I did. So I thought, well, that was quite easy, really. I could do that. So when I got asked, what did you on this? I could say, I did the brickwork. And people went, oh, that's good. So that's quite a nice ego trip. After that, we then decided we would build Penpool, our French layout. I taught French. I love France. I'm a total Francophile. So the opportunity of going and doing research in a country I loved was great. So it took us a long time to do the research, usually combined with how much red wine we were drinking, you know, or how needed to replenish. But no, we had a great laugh and we used to go and had a lovely, lovely time. And I got really involved in the work that went with Penpool. But when we were still doing Penpool, people would ask us to go and show them at shows how we did stuff. And Gordon would do the scenery and I would do the buildings, scratch building the buildings. And I got approached by the organisers of the NEC show, the Worley show. And they said, you're quite good talking to people, aren't you? And I said, well, it is my job. I'm a teacher. And they said, well, we'd quite like to encourage children to get involved. And we're thinking now about 24 years ago. So it's a long while ago. And they said, would you be interested in having a stand at the Worley show at the NEC and put together basic buildings, 00 buildings. Pico will provide them for you. Squires will give you the tools and the glues and everything else. And would you like to do that? And I thought, well, why not? So Gordon helped me to start off with, and it was a huge success.
So how many people would be attending at any one time?
At the NEC, during a weekend in the early days, we'd see 40 or 50 children a day.
Oh my goodness.
About.
That's a decent sized class.
Yeah, but they would come in, they would come ones and twos. They were never all together. They'd come and do the kit, take it away, come and do the kit, take it away. Well, with that sort of numbers, just Gordon and I and another friend, the three of us, we couldn't cope. So my team now, 20-odd years later, is a team of 9. And last November, we saw 190 children over the 2 days.
Whoa.
And we were exhausted.
Wally's packed.
Wally's packed.
Anyway, and then people bringing their kids as well. It's almost like you're running sort of a creche for them.
No, no, it's not a creche. on the programme, it tells everybody we're not a creche. Mm-hmm. The children stay for about 20 minutes. The kits we're given are very, very basic and very simple, and they last about 20 minutes, half an hour.
Because I guess that would be the fear for me running that kind of thing, is that I'm just going to get dumped with somebody's children whilst they go off and have a look at the show.
It started off a little bit like that, and we made a big point about saying they will be ready in 20 minutes. The advent of mobile phones has been amazing, because it does mean that a child normally, if they're left with us, they have a mobile phone. And then they ring dad, mum, granny, grandpa to say, I'm ready, come and get me. Mm-hmm. We never let a child go until the parent or grandparent has come to collect them. We always make sure we give them a name. We have name badges, sticky name badges, because we all wear names, so they know who we are. So they all have a sticky name badge, so we can actually have a name. If we got not stuck with them, and if they stayed with us, we could get an outspeaker announcement out. When we first started, we had a little boy. Well, he's no longer a little boy, he's a man now, Michael. And Michael would arrive within 3 minutes of opening. Him and his dad always bought advance tickets.
Did he sprint there from
At the beginning, we were the furthest away from the door. We were down by the refreshment area so that the parents could sit and have a refreshment while the children were working with us. Michael would arrive within 3 minutes, puffing and panting. He would make one of the kits, sit down, make one of the kits, and off he'd go. Dad would come and collect him, and off he'd go. Michael is now working for Network Rail. He still comes and says hello.
So he's building one-to-one scale kits now?
Yeah, he's building one-to-one. And he still comes and says hello, always. We have a young lady who used to come, and she made most of the kits we had on offer over the years. And then she came and she said, could she bring her own kit and help her. So we said, of course. So she went off and brought her own kit. Dad paid for it, and they sat down and got, because at Worley it's no cost, it's free to do it. The following year she came and she brought an elephant, to which we looked at it and said, why have you brought an elephant? She said, well, I'm doing a special topic for my GCSE and I want to make a woolly mammoth. So this elephant and her sat in a corner, and she went and got some scatter material, and she sat there and made a woolly mammoth all through our class, which was fine. There's another young lady called Samantha, who we have regulars, as you can hear. We have a lot of regulars, but Samantha doesn't only come to the NEC. Samantha now comes to York, because an offshoot of this was that the exhibition organiser of York decided that he would like a children's workshop at the York show at Easter. Now, the team I've got of nine that do Worley, basically, I don't need that many for York. It isn't as manic. It is manic, but not as manic. So there's just four of us there. And it's exactly the same. The children come, choose what they want to build, and they sit with us and we help them. Knocking on from that is that Pikarama decided that it'd be a really good idea if I worked down there in the summer, doing exactly the same thing, putting the kits together. And so it started off, I did one whole week in the school summer holidays. I then decided it would be better, rather than do one whole week, to do one day a week during the school holidays, because it broadened the number of people who could do it. It was fine if you happened to be on holiday that week, but if you weren't, you missed out. And again, we have the regulars who come. It's 21 years this year since I started.
Wow.
And this year will be my last year. I've decided that 21 years is enough.
Yeah.
And I think they're looking, and I think they found somebody who will carry it on after me.
What I find amazing is that you started with Worley. So you started right at the most busiest, most manic end of it. Rather than starting from like a small one-on-one and building up, you went straight in with this enormous show.
I suppose it's because I was quite used to, I mean, I was used to teaching a class of children. I was a head of year, so I was used to talking to 200 and something children at one time and their parents. So it didn't faze me to work with, and it is really only one-on-one. Okay, you've got one-on-one and another one waiting, and one-on-one and another one waiting. So by the end of the day, you've seen a lot of children, but you're only ever talking to one child at a time. Mm. We made sure that we did do one-on-one. we didn't want to pontificate to a class because there'll be somebody who would be too shy to ask. And we have them from any age. If they're hold, if they can hold a paintbrush, because we use plastic weld glue and they put it on with a paintbrush. We have people, older people, who come with their children or their grandchildren, and they expect it to be that nice polystyrene glue that goes everywhere and goes into string and everything.
And they, covers every surface.
Oh, covers every surface. And they don't understand that plastic weld is like water and you have to use it fairly quickly, but you use it with a brush. And so we have parents and grandparents looking at us in total amazement that all you do is whop with a brush, put the two pieces together and it's stuck. The children think it's magic. Mm. We count up to five, put the glue on, count up to five very slowly. And look, it's stuck. And their little faces, particularly the little ones. If a child, as I say, can hold a paintbrush, they sit on my knee sometimes because they're too little, or one of my colleagues' knee, and they put their kit together. Mm. We try to direct them into what kit to have, because we have from a simple pagoda building, a garage, right through to a signal box, a small signal box, which is a lot fiddlier.
So how many parts, individual parts, would those kits be? Right at the bottom end?
Right at the bottom, four.
Four walls
and a roof, mm-hmm. basically. And the roof is in a single piece, so that goes on, dead simple. By the time you get to garages, signal boxes, then you have two pieces for the roof and the ridge. So it's a bit more fiddly. Pico are very good. They let me advise them on what kits I want. And they also package them just in plastic bags for me. They don't come on bits of card like you would buy in the shop. They're separately packaged for me.
That's really good that they are providing stuff specifically tailored to your needs.
Yes, they do. I was down at Pico last weekend. I've given them a list of what I need for the York show. But down at Picorama, they want now to do a mini modelling course for children. First time, we're hoping it'll be in the May half term this year.
Would that be more of an intensive course?
Yes, that will be a bookable course. And at the end of it, a child would go away with a piece of scenery and a building in the scenery.
What age range are we looking at?
Seven upwards.
Okay.
And it'll be bookable online. And we reckoned it'll be a 2-hour morning or afternoon thing. I think they were thinking about charging about £10 to do it. The kits that they donate to us are not cheap. If you were to buy them in the shop, they are not cheap. And obviously to do the scenery and to put a hedge, grass and all the other things, it would be teaching. It's to me, what is the next step? They've made their buildings, put it in a scene. And because of how Gordon has shown me how to use his scenic materials, Ben and Pico have their own scenic materials, their static grass machines and everything else. Then it means that I can show children how to do that.
From a parent's point of view, that's incredible value for money.
Oh, yes.
Because you're not, if you were doing it outside of that, you not only have the cost of the kit, but also the risk of it going wrong,
yeah.
and sort of the upset that goes with having spent that amount of money and not having anything to show for it.
And also the machines, the static grass machines, the bags of static fibres and all that, as an outlay, are quite expensive.
Yeah.
But obviously that outlay has already been taken by Pico, so they just have to use a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, as I say, I only was speaking to them last week about it. It's all being sorted for this May as a one-off to see how it works.
Yeah.
If it works, then it will happen again.
Yeah. As an adult, you're kind of taking on quite a lot of financial risk when you're buying these really expensive toys. So being able to just borrow one for the bit you need to do is a fantastic idea.
I do scenic workshops at Stevenage. There's an annual show in Stevenage in January. And I've been doing scenic workshops there. I started off doing buildings. I started off showing people, adults, how I do scenery, because Gordon was always inundated with people asking him how he did scenery. So I said, well, I know how to do it. I can do it with you. And I discovered that maybe children like talking to a woman more than they like talking to a man. I don't know. But I found that lots of children would sit down and talk to me while Gordon was talking to their parents. And so I ended up showing a child what to do And so the children would have a go at putting the static grass on, putting a little bush on, and taking away a tiny piece, size of a postcard, piece of scenery. And as you say, it gave them the chance to use equipment, £80 a time, which is a big outlay unless you're going to use it over and over again. What we often say to parents is, get a group of you together and buy one between you.
To share it.
To share it, because it is a large outlay, some of this machinery.
We talked a little bit about Wally and Picarama. Am I right in thinking that you also do some courses at Pendant?
I used to.
Yeah.
I was asked, would I do the intensive courses in Pendant, which were like we're going to do in Picarama in May, if it happens. Pendant asked me, would I do modelling workshops? Gordon at that time was doing workshops at Pendant for tree making and, yeah, mainly for tree making.
Were those aimed at adults?
Yes, those were aimed at adults. And so the question came up, what about children? And I said, well, I'm quite happy, if you are, for me to run a children's workshop to do a piece of scenery with a model building on exactly what I'm going to be doing down at Picarama. And it worked very well. But Pendant is not exactly next door to where we live. It's quite a distance. And I was quite happy to carry on. But there were people much nearer to Pendant who were willing to take it on. And when I did it, it was you had to pay to do it. But what they've done now is they have a drop-in session at Pendant with a couple of gentlemen, I think it's at least two, if not more, who've taken on the mantle. And they just do a drop-in session, not with a building. I don't think it's with a building, but a little piece of scenery. And the parents sit and watch or get involved. So once you've gone into Pendant, you can have a go at making this bit of... It's just first come, first served. You don't book it at all.
And how well subscribed are those?
Very. Very, very, very. They've been very popular. It's every Wednesday during school holidays.
Oh, wow. It's quite an undertaking to actually commit the time to do that as well.
But that's why it's people who live locally or nearer who can get involved. I think the team is getting bigger all the time so that you don't end up having to do it every week. Because much as it's wonderful and much as it's good fun and much as you like, I love doing it, it can get a bit, not boring, but it's a commitment. And suddenly you need to go to the dentist or suddenly your grandchildren ring up and say, Granny, can you come and play or something like that? And you can't because you've made a commitment. So in a way, it's good to have a selection of people who can drop in, drop out, so you're not committed.
One thing that I found as a problem when organising voluntary projects is that we often start with a lot of people and it becomes fewer and fewer as time goes on and people have other commitments. But with that, how did you manage to get people involved to teach as well?
What, a Pendant?
Well,
or anywhere?
At any of these projects, trying to get people involved and spending their spare time effectively in a voluntary role teaching others is quite difficult, I found.
I've got a very, very, very good team. I selected them. They're friends of mine. I have a couple who come from Sussex, two couples who come from Leeds. I have a gentleman who comes from York, and we all meet at Worley as a group. And then there's obviously Gordon and myself. And we get on as friends as well. And we only do it for Worley, that group. In the size of that group, only ever gets together at Worley. So it is only once a year for 2 days. It's hard work. Worley, a lot of exhibitions, they look after you quite well. If you are an exhibitor, they look after you quite well. You get fed and watered. And of course, in the evening, you are away from home in a form of accommodation. The accommodation is usually very nice. And so you have a social evening as well where you can meet up, you can catch up with news. And that side is the social side of railway modelling. Lots of people look at railway modelling and say, oh, you do that? Ooh, it must be so boring. But it isn't. It's like a party. When you get involved in the exhibitions, then you know that you're going to be in one part of the country this weekend. Then in a couple of weekends' time, you're going to be another part of the country. And the chances are that the people in both places, there will be somebody who you know in both places. And so you catch up, you go out for a drink with them, you have breakfast with them, and it's just social.
It's building that network of friends.
It is.
Like yes. Getting the gang back together.
Yes, it is. And the friends that I have who work with me in Worley have been working with me now for, must be 20 years nearly. Three of them who live in Leeds, they helped me at York as well. I couldn't do without them because it's a bit like Topsy. It's grown and grown and grown and grown. And I can't do it without somebody else. It's just not right.
How would you go about recruiting new people to do it?
I'd have to select them. They'd have to be people I like. I know that sounds awful, but if you're going to be in close proximity for two whole days and socialising with them in the evenings, then you don't particularly want people you don't get on with. I think that the nine I've got, the 8/9, depending whether Gordon works with us or not, is the most I'd want because it would get too unwieldy. With 8, you have 4 people working with children at any one time. You have one person doing what I call front of house, which is getting the children's name, getting them to choose what model they want to make, advising in a strange sort of way. So that's 5 of you. There's nearly always 2 who've gone off to the loo or gone to get a coffee or something like that. And so you have 1 floater. And then everybody changes over. You do maybe an hour, hour and a half, and then you change over.
I guess that's really important to prevent fatigue within
Absolutely.
The team.
And also, most of the people there are railway modellers anyway. Most of them are interested in railway modellers. And they also want to look at the show a little bit. You hear of such and such a layout there and you haven't seen that, so you want to go and find it and look at it. So that works quite well, that you have a little bit of time off. I must admit, last November at the NEC with nearly 200 children over the 2 days was manic. We hardly got any time off at all. We think it's all down to the Great Railway Challenge.
Hmm. Well, we've spoken about that on the podcast before, about how to bring in new people to the hobby.
And we think that the winners were there, the ladies' team was there showing their model, and we think that definitely there were more children there this year. There were a lot of children there last year, but definitely this year there were more children, and they all wanted to have a go.
And is brilliant. Really.
Which is fantastic. Yeah. And you heard the parents say, just think, if you did that really well, you could be on the challenge, which is wonderful. Because if we don't get children involved in the hobby, it could die.
This is the thing. This is the really important thing, is that we need... I mean, the cost of even entering the hobby is going up all the time.
That's right.
And, you know, it's not getting any cheaper to raise children.
Yeah.
So it's getting very, I think, possibly out of reach for a lot of people. And being able to show people a way that they can do it themselves is really important. Yeah. And that it doesn't have to cost the earth.
And I think a lot of things that I'm doing, the bases that I'm using for scenery, it's polystyrene. It's waste polystyrene packaging. The buildings that you use, you don't have to use plastic buildings. You could use a cardboard building. You could make it yourself. I'm quite sure that there will be people who made tunnels out of shoeboxes. You know, I did with my son. I can remember doing that. Well, you don't have to have expensive equipment. You don't have to have out-of-the-box stuff. There is the possibility of making it. And people were always asking me, oh, surely in this computer age, people don't want to get involved with making. But there has been a shift, definitely a shift, that children want something that they have produced themselves.
When you plant that seed as well, they can start looking around their environment and saying, well, I could use that for this purpose. I can use this cereal packet as this fit in for the building. Mm-hmm. I can use... There was somebody I saw recently, and admittedly they're an adult, but they built a locomotive out of golden syrup cans.
Right.
So it's brilliant. Yeah. Just using those bits from your environment, the materials that you need or the shapes that you need.
Yes.
And planting that seed. Because I think when... I mean, I sound like my parents now, but in this age of video games and things like that, where everything comes in a box and it comes, this is how you play with it. These are the instructions on how you play with it. We need to give people an experience of how you make stuff and how you come up and create things in this way.
But don't you think that once you've been told this is how you play with it, there's no scope then for going off on your own?
Exactly.
And I play games on my computer, and I'm sure lots of people do. But once you've mastered how to get to the next level, that's the same for the next level and the next level. And the boredom sets in.
Very defined parameters.
Yes. Whereas once you're creating something with your hands, then you just can go anywhere. Mm-hmm. If you want a tree, then dig up a weed from the garden. shake it, turn the root upside down, and the chances are it doesn't look bad for a tree.
I should have known that.
but it's as you say, it's looking out of the box. And by giving them that little push, who knows? I'm not saying that technology hasn't got a place, because lots and lots of young people now, they control their locos from their mobile phone.
And so many of them are learning CAD technology so that they can then print things at home to go with their layouts.
Because if somebody asked me to operate my train set from my mobile phone, I'd go, you must be joking, because I wouldn't have a clue. I like a knob to turn or a switch to press. But for young people, it doesn't faze them. But they still need to be able to make. They like to put things together. Children always have done. Plasticine, boxes, imagination.
Well, first it was FEMO.
Yes, of course it was.
And cardboard boxes.
Yes, absolutely.
And lots of sellotape and some pens.
Yep. And that way you've got to make them explore their environment. And if we can get them doing that, then who knows what will follow. People were saying, oh, the Great Railway Challenge, you wouldn't have an alien coming in, you wouldn't have this, you wouldn't have that. Okay, you wouldn't. But it just inspired a bit of imagination.
Well, look at the success that Laurie Colvert had with Kato Pass and this sci-fi steampunk style stuff. Absolutely. And now there's a model range of it.
That's right.
Other things that I loved about that challenge were the scratch building challenge, where the objective is to take these unlikely objects and turn them into something. Yeah. And seeing how different people process that, because some people can be quite literal, especially, admittedly, I am, in railway modelling circles. And trying to push people to think, well, what is a novel use I can use this for?
The other thing as well, though, in that scratch built challenge is, why not give them, you need to make this. Here's a box of scrap. Make it. Mm-hmm. And then you're thinking even more out of the box. You're not even being given the parameter of this is a loo brush. You're being told, I need you to make a tree. Make it from what's there.
Yeah, it's like those programs back in the day. Scrap Heap Challenge was great for that. Yes. You need to build, you know, a minesweeper out of scrap.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
And that concentrates the mind a little bit more than going the other way and being given something and make it into something.
Yes, because I guess having an open brief is almost harder, especially if you're not used to creation and coming up with something, rather than having an objective that you need to achieve.
And then finding the material to make it. Mm. Yeah, definitely.
The media is often telling us about how children have short attention spans. Have you found this to be true? And if so, how do you deal with it?
If they are really interested in what they're doing, they will go through to the end to get it done properly. If they are not that bothered, then they get distracted very, very easily. And I think that's the same for grown-ups as well. I don't think it's just children. They hear a noise and they suddenly want to look at it. But if they are totally concentrating on getting something finished, usually with the tongue sticking out, as they often do when they concentrate, then they will not be distracted by anybody. In fact, you can almost talk to them and they won't reply because they are busy doing something. I think when you've got children, you have to find what it is that they're interested in. And once you've got that interest, they will keep it going as long as they possibly can. It's like we were saying earlier about computer games. They will get bored with those because it's the same thing over and over again. So when I'm doing the modelling with them, particularly a kit, then we look at the kit first, when it's still on the sprue, to see what bits what. We identify the pieces. They usually are pretty good at that, doors, windows and what have you. And then we talk about how it's going to put together. So it's always a conversation with them of what do you think goes where. And it's making them think what goes where and what they need to do next. Very often they'll say, well, I want to do it this way. And I say, well, if you do it that way, it'll be difficult. But if you want to do it that way, that's absolutely fine. But most of the time they take my advice or the advice of some of my team and we do change it slightly. The biggest problem is often a roof. They like to do the roof and put the ridge on last, which if you were making a proper building, you would put the ridge on last because of the gap. When you're making a model building, the best way is to put the ridge on first because then you know how big a gap to leave before you put the sides on for the roof.
I wish I'd come to one of these sessions. This would have saved me so much time.
That's what lots of people say. You're not the first. Because you need to have a gap. You don't want to put the ridge on top of the roof pieces. You want them to butt up nicely.
Yes. It all becomes so clear.
It all becomes clearer. Oh, I have got probably hundreds of children who are perfect at putting roofs on simply because we have taught them well. Keeping them interested, giving them something different to do, talking to them. Most of them want to please you about doing it well.
Is that because you're the holder of the knowledge?
Probably. They come and they sit down and we smile and talk and find out a little bit about them. And then very often the parents will look across because very often the parents stop to watch. We don't like the parents sitting too close, but particularly at Worley, we have an area where parents can sit and wait for the children to be finished.
Is there an element that you're also kind of teaching the parents how to teach the children how to do it?
Could be.
Because if they don't know how to do it themselves, they might be curious as to if they buy a kit and take it home. Yeah.
Some of the parents do like to sit with us, but don't interfere. They let us do what we want to do. Some don't. Some just sit and let us take over. It just depends on the parents. But once you've got the child working and wanting it to be as good as they can make it, they are so proud of what they've made. We always put it in a bag for them to take it away. We always put their name label on it so that they know it's theirs. And very often the parents will say, I never thought they'd be able to do that. How did you get them to concentrate? They don't normally concentrate like that. I didn't think they'd be interested. And unfortunately, what we often get, it's not as bad as it used to be, but we often used to get parents and children walking past our stand at Worley because it's so busy. And they'd walk past and maybe it was a little girl. And the little girl would have a look and see what we were doing. And we'd always smile and say, would you like a go? And the parent would say, no, she doesn't want it.
That's shocking.
It's awful. But it used to happen. It doesn't happen as much because girls are fighting the fight, if you like. But it did happen. No, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. And it's almost a case of, well, you're a girl, so you don't do it. It's working a lot better because on my team of eight, five of us are women. So therefore, they can see it's women doing it. Yes. So they're very happy to come and work with us. Sometimes we get little boys who are quite small, five-year-olds. We can deal with five-year-olds, no problem. And they'll look and you say, would you like a go? And they look up at mummy or daddy or granny or grandpa, whoever, and the child looks like they might want to go. And the parent says, oh, no, I don't think he'd have enough concentration. And then the child gets taken off.
I wonder if that perception that we've got is when you're trying to force a child to do something that they don't want to do, maybe their attention span is short.
Yeah.
But you're right, when they can get their teeth into something and they really want to achieve it.
And they want to be proud of what they've done as well. They don't want to take shortcuts. They want to do it properly. Mm. And then they want to be able to show mum, dad, granny, whoever. And very often we have children who come year on year. We see the same children year on year. And they say, we've made that one. It's on my mantelpiece. We've made that one. That's on my layout. We've made that one. Oh, you've got a new one. We'll do that one. And it's wonderful.
Yeah. You say that most of them are repeat visitors. What sort of ratio to new people to repeat visitors do you think there are?
We probably see 70% new, 30% repeat.
Okay.
Yeah, about that, I would think.
I think that Worley or any exhibition really is a great place to do it because they can see what they want to achieve elsewhere in the show too.
Yes.
It's not an abstract concept to them. It's right there. I want to build a railway. I've seen lots of railways. I want to build one. They've all got buildings. I want a building.
That's right. That's very much the case. And also because there are stands at a place like Worley where you can go and buy a kit. There are kits available. So, oh, look, I've made one. I'll go and buy another one because I know how to do it now, which is really good. Squires, the model equipment company, is our saviour because they supply us with all our tools and all our bits and pieces that we need to put a kit together. And they are usually very close to where we are in Worley. So people will say, oh, where did you get that particular knife? Where did you get that particular pair of tweezers? Where did you get the glue? And you say, just over there. And so I know it's obviously a sales pitch as well, but it does help to know that, yes, they've enjoyed it. Yes, they want to do it again. It's just over there. And it's November, Christmas coming up.
Yeah.
And very
often, a lot of lists being made at Wally.
Yeah. And a lot of people do. You get parents who come and see what we're doing and then have a little wink and a smile and they say, we'll be back. And off they go. And so you can quite be sure that there's a little package that's going to be parcelled up for Santa to give said child for Christmas.
Aside from the Woolly Mammoth project, do you get many other instances of people bringing a kit that they've bought maybe at the show to come and build with you?
Yes, not a lot, but we do get several. We get several at York more than at Worley.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know why we get more at York. I suppose it's smaller. There's only four of us at York who work with children, whereas at Worley, as I said, there's nine of us. So maybe they feel a little bit more at ease that they can bring their own kit to work with us. We have all sorts of things that come.
What's been one of the most challenging ones?
One of the most challenging ones. Last year at York, somebody brought a Thunderbird. It was a kit that the father had had for obviously n number of years. And the daughter came with this big box and said, Daddy says, can we make Thunderbird? And I think it was Thunderbird 4, but I can't swear to that. And so they sat and they made Thunderbird. And it's the wrong sort of plastic because it's old plastic. A new plastic is obviously a different composition now. And when you think, when Thunderbird 4, the original box from whatever,
maybe 65.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. So this plastic had been gradually decaying, if that's the right word. Or
maturing.
But thank you, that's a better word, maturing. And so it was quite a challenge to put it together. But one of my team helped this young lady and it was a success. We actually made Thunderbird for her.
That's brilliant.
Such a laugh, though.
How long did it take?
2 hours.
Wow.
Usually most of our kits take about half an hour.
Yeah, so that was the exception.
Yeah, but where we are, we stuck her in a corner with my colleague who they just got on with it while the rest of us worked with the other children.
That's great. Yeah, because I guess if I was a child, then I would love to go and buy a kit and then build something to take home ready-made for my railway at home. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? And from Squires and Pico's point of view, this is almost like an investment in their future.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. And in both cases, we have Squires and Pico are close by to our stands, both in Worley and in York. So whenever we're asked, where can we get? You just say, down there, over there, or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's a more general sort of question. Where and what age do you think it's best to start with getting children into the hobby?
Oh, that's a difficult one.
It's a big question, really, and it's one that a lot of people are asking each other.
Yes. If you have a child who is interested in trains, the chances are it's granddad or dad who's interested in trains initially. And they think, a bit like we did with our son, they need a train set. And you wonder who the train set really is for. A friend of ours was asking us about a Thomas train set, I think it was, where it picks up the mail van.
Yeah.
And he wanted to buy this for his grandson's birthday. And we said, oh, yes, we know where you can get that from. And I said, well, how old's your grandson? And he was 18 months. So we do think that's maybe a little early to do a train that picks up a mailbag. But if they're interested enough, the chances are that maybe they've had a Brio set to start off with, which is wonderful because push, 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 you can get something going round a track. So that's maybe your first step. And that could be from as soon as they can get hold of something. That could then progress possibly to Thomas. Because they'll have read the books. You know, it's one of those things. If a child's interested in trains, the chances are somebody's bought them a Thomas book or bought them a Thomas model. And they like it. And you sometimes see them at shows that for children to play with, which is great. But then what happens next? Because you can buy your Thomas to go round and round and round and round. But by the time you're 7, maybe 8, if you're really interested, you want it to do more than go round and round and round and round. You want it to maybe have a loop. You want to have points. You want to be able to shunt even.
Or multiple train operations.
Or multiple train operations. So how do you work that in? And that's when you have to start being a little bit more logical in how you operate. Going round and round and round as fast as you can. Yeah, lovely. It's like Scalextrics. You go as fast as you can till the car comes off. And I can remember doing that. But with a train set, you don't want them coming off because that isn't real. They need to go round. So probably 7 or 8, you could start adapting a little bit. But that's almost when you have to start buying it yourself and making it yourself. Because the circle of track you need to add to. So you need to get the add-ons. And that can start being a little bit complicated because what do you want? You have to do a track plan. That's maybe a little bit too much for a child. Or knowing some children, it's going to be too adventurous. They're going to have sidings and they're going to have all sorts of things happening. So maybe you need to just pull them in a little bit for that. Controlling it, yes, you can have a switch that controls, but nowadays you've got mobile phones. And by the time you're 12, 13, if you're still interested, use your mobile phone to do it. Mm. It brings in a form of technology which allows the child to use what they're good at to operate something that I'm good at. Because I could never use a mobile phone. I would be absolutely lost. I wouldn't know the first end of it. In fact, I find enough trouble making an ordinary mobile, using my phone normally. So that would be difficult. But for children, they are not fazed by technology.
Well, I guess they've just grown up with
it. They've grown up with it. You know, I mean, everybody laughs, don't they? And say, if your computer's is playing up, you give it to a 6-year-old and they'll sort it out. Well, probably yes, because they're not frightened of it. I think as we get older, particularly grandparents in particular, I think they're scared of technology.
This gives me an image in my head of drop-in centres at exhibitions for children to fix your DCC locos while you say, wait, maybe we can flip the tables a bit. For parents, we've talked a little bit about this in that the parent needs some sort of aptitude to be able to teach the children. And I think that's something that your stand does so well, in that it provides the children with these skills that the parent may not have. And do you think that's happened often? Because when the child wants to go to the next level with their layout, they need a lot of help with that. And I wonder if, is the parent's skills a limitation on that?
It can be, but then we're finding that there are some of the larger railway clubs that are encouraging a young membership to help them do that next stage. Because like you say, a lot of parents haven't the time, haven't the skill, haven't the interest. Grandparents are a wonderful resource if they live colloquially.
Yeah.
But very often in the past, granddad, grandma was the other end of the street or around the corner or at least in the same town. But nowadays, people aren't in the same town.
Hours away, yeah.
Yeah, my own grandchildren live near Oxford. So, you know, they are a long way away. We don't see them as much as we'd like to. They have a life. They have things that they're doing. Children are always busy. Parents spend a lot of time taking children to art class, if there's that, gym, football, all the rest of it. So their time with their children is very limited. So it does need somebody else sometimes. We do it at our shows to try and help people get involved. But once they want another go, we hope we've given them enough skills to take it that little bit further, maybe even to show mum and dad, granny and grandpa, how it works. If they want to go even further, then you really do need people who know what they're doing. And that's why I think we need to encourage railway clubs to have a junior division. Mm. And people then say, yes, but what about all the laws and the rules about children and working with children and everything else? Well, I think in those cases, you ask a parent to go with them. Mm. Because then the parent would learn as well, by osmosis, if you like, and they'd be around so they could help the child when they get home. There's a club in the Sussex area that has a very good junior division. And what they did some time ago was they allowed a certain amount of money to the junior division to make a train set. And the train set had to be exhibitable at their own show.
Wow. So giving them that objective and a budget,
yeah,
it sort of forced them to do it in a way, but in a good way. I mean,
but it also concentrated the mind. And they were told that they had to do it, but they could ask advice.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. And then also, like you say before, about being proud of their achievements, they've got something tangible to show for it at the end.
At a show.
Yeah, at a show. A recurring theme on this podcast has been about going through childhood as a railway enthusiast and how it's been different for different people in different times and different places. For me, I've talked about how I felt like I had to hide my hobby. I think that may be going away a little bit with more public exposure to it and more acceptance of it. How would you advise people to destigmatize the hobby for younger people?
It's not cool. It's definitely not a cool hobby to be involved in. Like you say, there are anecdotal evidence that if you had a copy of one of the railway magazines, you kept it in your top drawer. If you were in the office, or you put it inside a Playboy magazine, you know, because a Playboy magazine was perfectly acceptable, whereas a railway magazine wasn't. Go to the States, and it's considered to be a very, very good thing to do, railroading. Because in the States, it's something that you boast about on your CVs, because it shows dedication, it shows research skills, it shows engineering skills, it shows all sorts of different things that are out of the norm, if you like. And I've heard that in the States, definitely it's one of the things that you put on your CV, whereas in England, you certainly wouldn't. It'd be one of those things in the past.
I think I would now. Because it makes me a more interesting person now. Yes. But certainly when I left school, absolutely not. No.
And even so now, you get a lot of children who come and they don't actually tell people that they have a model railway at home. And it's still there.
It makes me so sad that.
It is really sad. But I think, much as some people don't like it, I think the Great Railway Challenge has helped. You've now got children watching things that are fun. They laugh. You always had the Thomas the Tank stories, but that was a story.
Yeah.
That was just from a book. Whereas you're now seeing people making things. Okay, sometimes they're making a right mess of it, but that's what happens. I think one of the big problems as well is that we almost live in a perfect society. Children are not brought up to fail. They always have to succeed. They always have to do it right. As a teacher, there were very often children would not participate in class because they were scared they'd get the answer wrong and people would laugh at them. And I think that we need to come away from that, and we have to accept the fact that whatever you do, if you've done it to the best of your ability, then you are a success. And that's why when I've got children who put glue everywhere, it goes all over them, it goes all over me, it goes all over the model. Luckily, Plastic Weld doesn't stick fingers, thank goodness, otherwise we'd be stuck to it forever. And there's gobby marks everywhere, but they love it and they've made it and they are proud of it. And I think if we can start engendering that into children, that whatever you do, if you've done it and it's the best you possibly can do, then it's worth doing. And I think that maybe more and more, maybe with the Great Railway Challenge, maybe with the more and things that are happening at railway shows and getting children involved and children going to shows, there is definitely an upturn in children going to shows and wanting to see what's going on. Maybe it won't be the nerdy hobby that everybody says. People often used to say to me, "You do model railways?" I'm saying yes. And I'm going out with a friend tonight. And if I was at home, I'd be sitting watching the telly. And I'm going to meet more friends. And somebody is going to say nice things about what I'm doing. And it's a real ego trip.
And travelling.
And, yeah.
And meeting new people. That's right. And experiencing new places.
Yeah.
And what you say about failure is really interesting, because Adam Savage talks a lot about failure and how we perceive failure, when really failure is an essential part of iterative design.
Yes.
Or any developing of a skill. I noticed a lot when I was at school, and I think people I know who teach, some children feel like they'll give it a go, but if it goes wrong, it's the end of the world. And they'd never want to try again because it went wrong the first time. And that's not healthy, I think. And what you need is for them to come back and try again.
Yes.
And how do you encourage that when you have somebody who maybe gets quite upset about things not going their way?
Very much so if I'm doing a scenic demonstration, more than putting a kit together, because a kit together either goes together or it doesn't. And the kits we use go together. There's never any problem about that. But with a scenic demonstration, sometimes the grass doesn't work as well as they want it to do. Sometimes they spill something that's in the wrong place and, oh, dear me, this is awful, this is terrible. And you say, well, hang on a minute, let's see what we can do to make what's gone wrong part of what we're doing. And I can remember doing a scenic demonstration with one young man, and he wanted a path through his model. He put some grass on his bit of polystyrene, and for the paths, I use ash from my wood fire. And so he was scattering the ash, and as he did it, he put too much. Oh, this is awful, this is terrible. I said, okay, let's have a decision. What we're going to have? Well, where that is there, shall we make it into a car park? Oh, that's a good idea. So we made it into a car park. So we used a mistake into something else.
Salvaging it.
And you salvage it. So yes, you failed in your initial idea, but you've adapted it for the circumstances that you've got. If you have one young man decided that he brought with him an aeroplane on his bit of scenery. This was at Pendon. He brought with him an aeroplane. And I looked at this little aeroplane. I said, why are we having an aeroplane? He said, because it's going to have crashed. And so his whole scene was a little building that he smashed to make it look like it had been caught by the plane as the plane was coming into land. And then he made the whole board, about an A5 sheet of polystyrene, he made it into a bomb site. But he came with that idea.
Dramatic.
And it was not what I'd have expected whatsoever.
How old was he?
8.
I wonder if he'd seen it in a film or something.
May
like
well
that.
Have done.
Yeah.
But he had the plane hitting, allegedly hitting the building. So the building got smashed and he had just soil. Well, I use real soil for the black stuff. And he put soil and ash and then the plane landed into the polystyrene.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought, good on you, Sunshine, because that is not a railway. But that's the other thing as well, that when they're building some of their buildings and when they're doing the scenery, it doesn't have to be railways. If I'm making a little garage with them, and a garage, if it's in 00, it's a garage. If it's in N gauge, it's an engine shed. It could also be a stable. It could be all sorts of things. It is just a oblong building. Then we start talking about what else you could use it for. And sometimes it's, well, I've got a doll's house, or I want to do this, I want to do something else. And like the lad with his bomb site, why not look outside the box? It isn't necessarily railway modelling, it's modelling. And once you've done the modelling, that might well go to railway. But if they're making stuff, then eventually, maybe when they've got their own children, when they're grandfathers or whatever, they then may return to model railways.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And there's a huge rise in interest in things like tabletop gaming,
yes.
Warhammer, Dungeons and Dragons, yeah. Bolt action, that kind of thing at the moment. So those are all transferable skills within that because it's all the modelling. It's all
modelling.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's Dungeons and Dragons because that's imaginary. But
it's still modelling.
Yeah,
it's still
yeah.
using your brain. It's still using your imagination.
Yeah.
And once you've clicked into that imagination, then you're not going to be bored because your imagination will take you on flights of fancy wherever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Spurring on that imagination and harnessing it. Because
yeah.
kids, when you get them going, they have unlimited imagination, really.
Ask a small child to tell you a story. And in that story, tell them, I want in that story there to be a pot of gold. I want there to be a dragon. And I want them to be a well, and you'll get however many children you talk to, you'll get that many different stories because you just let them go.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that's because they haven't had these traditional stories drilled into them? Like, for example, I have, you know, watching films all the time, every film follows a very similar structure. They've got almost unlimited possibilities.
Yes. I think schools are very good as well as getting them to think outside the box. One of my granddaughters, they have spellings to learn, like you probably had and like I probably had when you were at junior school. But when they learn the spellings, they have to put each spelling into a sentence.
Yes, context.
A context. So they have to imagine, and I'm quite sure that of the how many children are in the class, if they've got watermelon, there will be one person talking about a watermelon being carried from the park to somewhere else. Somebody else will be having a watermelon smashed. Somebody, and so each child will have their own interpretation of putting it into context.
Changing tack a little bit, what drives you personally to do this?
Right. I could say my husband, but I won't. It all started because of him, obviously. Nothing to do with railways when we got married, as I said, to do with motor cars, motor racing. I love teaching. I feel very privileged that I've had that job. I feel very privileged that I have the ability to talk to people. I'm not fazed by talking to people. I am quite open and, I hope, easily approachable. So I find that I am happy to talk to people. I'm happy to tell people how I do things. I don't keep things close to my chest. I'm more willing to share than not. My life has always been about teaching. I'm still teaching at the moment, but I'm teaching exercise classes at the moment, so I'm still doing my stuff. It's never worried me to talk to people, to not tell them, not instruct them, but to guide them in how to do things.
Is that the key of teaching, to guide rather than to instruct?
Yeah, you have to let them find their own way. I could be very pedantic and say, you do this, you do that, you do the other. They do it. You know, they would follow my lead, I'm quite sure. But then if it went wrong, they wouldn't know how to get out of it. Whereas if you put them on the right path and give them various options on that path, then they can take it their own way. It's like my lad with his plane that went into the board. Everybody else was doing railway scenes, but he wasn't, because he decided that he would do something different and we could guide him along that path. So that sort of thing. I get great satisfaction out of seeing a child's face when they've achieved something. It's just one of those things. And I enjoy being with people. I don't like being isolated. I've just come from 2 weeks isolation because I went to Northern Italy. So it has killed me to be away from people for 2 weeks. But I am now totally clear and able to be out and about. So I'm making the most of it.
Can you name an experience that was the most rewarding for you whilst doing this teaching and modelling?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. I think the young lady who did the mammoth elephant.
That's so left field. It
was so out of everything that I just couldn't believe that she was going to come with all the stuff to sit down, having made kits with us, to say, I want to make this elephant into a mammoth. At a big show like Worley as well, at the NEC, and you just looked at her and I thought, well, okay, get on with it.
You came here.
You came here and she came ready prepared, and her father had got the stuff and had bought her the stuff that she needed. I mean, the father was extremely supportive of her. And I just thought, good on you. Good on you.
That's lovely. On the opposite end of the scale, what's been the most challenging experience?
Oh, dear. Usually an adult. Because
I'm sort of surprised and not surprised by that answer. I wasn't expecting it, but actually when you said it, I'm not surprised.
Some adults look at a female and think, whatever could they know about anything?
And in this day and age?
Still. It's not as bad as it used to be. It's like the young girls who come and now make models with us. It's not as bad as it used to be. But you have to remember, I've been doing this for 20 odd years. And it is getting better. But I think the most frustrating thing is that you have adults, I'm afraid usually men, who, what on earth could you know about anything? And as I suppose my name has got more well known in the hobby because of my husband and because of the work I do with my husband on our airways, people are now more accepting that I do know what I'm talking about. I know that sounds quite big-headed, but I do know what I'm talking about.
Not at all. I think one of the recurring themes of this podcast, and specifically the railway modelling episodes of this podcast, is representation. When you see people that are like you doing something you want to do, that makes you want to do it more, and makes it feel like I can achieve that too. So
for any young women who might come and want to do modelling, if they see you doing it to the standard you're doing it at, then that's such an incentive to say, well, this is accessible to me too.
We are getting more and more women into railway modelling, definitely. And at a quality end as well. We're not just getting ladies, women who want to poodle around and do what the men do. We're getting some very, very, very good railway modellers who are into electronics, who are into engineering, who make locos from scratch in N gauge right up to O gauge. So you've and even above O gauge. So you have got women getting involved, which is brilliant. Mm-hmm. Because why not? Mm. You have men doing cooking, you have men doing sewing, you have men doing what are traditionally women's crafts. So why not women doing what has always been considered to be a man's hobby? Mm. It is, as I think I said earlier, it is a great party that you go from one place to the other and you are welcomed. I find that because I am in the hobby, I'm not just Gordon's wife, I am part of the hobby.
Absolutely.
Then I think I get accepted. I once famously said, or maybe infamously said, that I'm treated as one of the lads. And I quite like being treated as one of the lads.
Well, really, we're just one big group anyway.
Exactly.
And that's the way it should be.
Yes.
We've talked a bit about how to expand the hobby to the younger generation and also between genders, but how would you promote equity and diversity by broadening the demographic? So model railways are often seen as quite a white middle class thing to do, often because of parental influence. But how, your experience of broadening the hobby, what would you bring to trying to expand it to more people from more different diverse backgrounds?
One of the problems we have is that a lot of interest in model railways is often steam. And when you think of who experienced steam, we're thinking of older people. And to have travelled on steam, probably quite a lot of people did, because that was the way of getting around. Cars weren't as plentiful as they are now. And I think the fact that we travel on them makes us want to replicate it. Some people have never been on a train. Young people in particular have never been on a train. They wouldn't know what one looked like, really, because they get in the car and they go from A to B in the car. Why waste time going from your house to the railway station? Might be late and then on. So you're trying to bring back the past, which is why with young people, it's quite difficult because they haven't got the steam pass. They've only got the diesel, the electric pass. But that's fine. That's fine. We are getting more ethnic people coming to shows. There's more interest. I think they're seeing that it would be quite a good idea to get creative. Because there is a minority, definitely. If you go to a show, it is mainly middle class white people, male as well. And if we're trying to encourage more people, then we need to hit the children and we need to make sure that it's possible for them to get involved. That's where a club would come in. And it's the interest. It's what floats your boat, if you like. How it's going to spread, I really don't know. We're hoping that the children will get involved. If the children get involved, they may encourage their parents to get involved. They may encourage people to get involved that way. But who knows? Really, who knows? It would be lovely if you could think that would be a hobby that was attainable for everybody. But sometimes it's finance, because it's not a cheap hobby. If you make your own stuff, it is, but not if you're buying off the shelf. Interest, ability, demographic, and peer pressure. I can't play with my train set because my friend will tell everybody and then everybody will laugh at me because I've got a train set. And that's what happens, that you get children. Children can be horrible to each other, absolutely horrible. But if you can get a small group who are really, really keen, then that
and,
is
and
a
support
nucleus
each other.
And support each other. And then have granny, grandpa, mum, dad also helping, or a club helping, then that nucleus will grow. The best clubs that I think I've ever met have been when there's been a nucleus of four, five, six adults who have been the nucleus of that club, who've been involved in everything. They've run the shows with other people helping. But if they kept going, then the club kept going. And I think that's what we need.
Because I want everyone to enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to share my hobby with everybody. So, and I want it to continue as well. And the major manufacturers won't be able to continue if they don't have enough of a market.
They're buying stuff, that's right.
So it's in all of our interests, really, to encourage everybody we can. What advice would you give to parents whose children have a hobby interest and they would like to help develop their children's interest, even if the parent themselves is not interested?
Obviously, encouragement, if they can. I wouldn't say throw money at it, because if you just say, I'll buy them that, I'll buy them that, I'll buy them the other, and then say, they are, get on with it. Well, if their children don't really know what they're doing, then that's a hiding to nothing, because the frustration would grow. If you can get them to a venue where it's happening, then great. Go and have a go. Go and look. Not necessarily model railways. It could be model anything. It could be football. It could be gymnastics. It could be anything. But get them to where there are experts doing it, so at least they can see how it should be done. It may well be that parents think, oh, this is quite nice, and they get involved as well. Doesn't often happen, but it can. Speak to other parents, see if you've got other children who might be interested, and then you've got a group, because once you've got a nucleus, again, like I was saying, if you've got a nucleus of children who can at least be supported by their parents or other adults, then that would help them not to feel so isolated, and then you can talk to each other. If you have a child who rings up their best mate because they don't know how to do their maths homework, well, why can't they ring up their best mate to say, look, I've got a train that I want to go around this track, why don't you come and play with me? And so, well, yeah, I'll do that. And you won't feel so weird.
Yeah. I only had a couple of friends who were sort of into it, but not to the extent that I was, certainly. But we'd had no internet at the time, so we had no online support at all. So you were kind of on your own there.
And of course, there's YouTube. There's YouTube, 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 and more YouTube.
I mean, most of the children that I speak to these days, their main entertainment is YouTube. Yeah. They don't watch TV as much anymore, but they watch so much YouTube.
Yes.
And there's so many big channels that have really got their teeth into that and appealed to that market and showing people how to do stuff.
And it is how to do.
Yeah.
And I think you can just put how to whatever and it comes up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But having said that, watching it on a screen and talking to a real person is slightly different. When you learn to teach, you can tell somebody, you can show somebody, but then you let them do it. And the telling and the showing are quite good, but you let them do it and they'll remember it far better than just reading about it, watching it be done, telling them about it.
Well, certainly I found that I learned best by doing.
Yes.
I struggle with instructions. I can't take in more than one at a time.
No.
And if the video goes on too quickly, I have to pause and rewind and that kind of thing.
And then you get frustrated.
Yes, yes, there have been occasions. If there are any club members or exhibition managers listening to this who think this sounds like a great idea, what advice would you give to them to start up a children's workshop at an exhibition?
You need to find a willing helper. Don't try and force it, because if you know a forced person is not good, because they would be giving off the wrong vibes because they're forced into doing it. The chances are that there will be somebody in most clubs, who would quite like to do it. I wouldn't suggest doing a whole weekend to start off with. Maybe just 2 or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. On one of the days, and have it as a feature, have it in the advertisement about it, saying there will be a children's workshop between this time and this time, drop in and see.
Great idea, because you could do it maybe around a break, like a natural lunch break or
something like that. It's not easy, it's not for everybody. Some people love it, some people hate it, some people find children a pain. It happens, they can be, but that's you have to have somebody who actually wants to do it. I'm very lucky that I, as I say, I have my team of eight others who want to do it, and I couldn't do it without them.
Mm.
Okay, I started off with just me and Gordon and another friend, and now we're at, there's nine of us, and I couldn't do it without them.
This year is the last year you're doing the sessions at Pikarama.
Yes, for the summer, yes.
How do you feel about handing over the reins?
If the people who I've suggested take over, it'll be fine. I will still work for PICOs at Worley and at York. And if this mini modelling thing works in May half term, then I'll carry on doing that for them. But I think 21 years is long enough.
Maggie, thanks so much for coming on Railway Mania. I really, really appreciate you coming down and talking about your specialist subject in this way. It's been a pleasure.
And for me too. Thank you so much.
Thanks to Maggie for coming on the show, and thanks everyone for tuning in. If you're not subscribed already, then please do so, so that you can stay up to date with new episodes. I'm so grateful to all of you for listening to this show, and I hope to bring you even more episodes soon.